Hello, this is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Yay!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The Vermont Cannabis Control Board is hard at work preparing the state for the opening of retail cannabis stores by the fall of 2022. This work involves a wide variety of issues, from regulations and licenses for both large and small growers, consumer protections and the state testing of products, youth prevention and education programs, highway safety issues, and the creation of a reliable and safe banking system for all related businesses. What are some of the biggest challenges facing the board in the coming months? That's one of the questions we have for our guest today. We have all three members of the Vermont Cannabis Board with us today, including James Pepper, who serves as the chairman of the board, also Julie Hulbert and Kyle Harris. I'd like to welcome all three of you to the program today, and thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Let's start off. I'd love to learn from all three of you your interest in serving on this board. This is something you had to apply for. You had to demonstrate a strong interest in this work and that you have some relevant work experience to bring to this project. So just start off today. Tell our listeners why you wanted to be on the board that's going to oversee virtually every aspect of the legalization and the creation of a retail cannabis market in the state of Vermont. James, what were the factors that led you to want to be on this board?
Well, I don't think anyone ever dreams of being a cannabis regulator when they grow up. That certainly wasn't the case for me. But my foray into cannabis policy came in around 2015. I was working for then Governor Peter Shumlin, and we had just received a report from the RAND organization that indicated roughly a quarter of Vermont adults use cannabis regularly, which by their definition meant the last 30 days. So for him, this became kind of an important consumer protection issue. And he assigned me to develop a regulated cannabis framework at the time that really built on the successes of Colorado, Washington, Oregon. And while I was ultimately, or we were ultimately unsuccessful in getting a bill across the finish line, I did in the meantime serve on Governor Scott's Marijuana Advisory Commission, as well as I audited the class to become a drug recognition expert. And you know, this work really felt like a natural progression of what I was doing. So that was my foray, and I'll turn it over to the other board members.
Okay, Julie, how about you?
So I think I disagree with Chair Pepper. If being a cannabis regulator was a thing growing up, I might have dreamed about it. I have a background in municipal government. I worked for about 8 years for the city of Burlington and then another 4 for the city of Winooski, and then moved into the nonprofit sector at VSAC just in 2019 before joining this board. I've also been a member of the Vermont State Ethics Commission and my local select board. So in terms of my interest in this role, it was really twofold. One is Vermont is my home. And as someone who understands and cares very much about the systems we put in place in our state and local governments and their impact on an everyday Vermonters, kind of going back to my municipal government and ethics commission life, this seemed like an opportunity to be, you know, at the start of something that really requires a great deal of care and consideration, but also implement something that is safe and equitable for Vermonters. My second is the strong sense for the need for justice. I come to this role understanding that regulating the sale of cannabis will not cure all ills, nor will it right the wrongs of the past. But we have an opportunity to do something different for the future. And I wanted to be a part of it and felt like I could bring some skills and experience to the table that would be useful.
Kyle, how about you?
Yeah, thank you. You know, I grew up on a small farm in Maryland. Agriculture has always been at the forefront of my mind. I tailored my legal education around the crux of environmental law and agricultural policy development. I spent time in D.C. working in and around agriculture policy, and most recently I was at the Agency of Agriculture here in Vermont, focusing on maple initiatives, dairy business innovation, and I served as the business liaison to the hemp team. So, you know, from a policy development perspective, what interests me, I thought it was a pretty logical progression based on those interests and where I wanted my career to go, to throw my hat into the ring and see what happened, and found my way, fortunately, onto the board.
James, from the outside, there could be some listeners who are thinking, this job is really not all that complicated. You have some people grow some cannabis, you package it, you tax it, and you sell it at a special cannabis store. But the actual mandate of your work is really quite comprehensive. You're dealing with small cultivators, large cultivators, environmental issues, energy issues, land use for agriculture, youth prevention, consumer protection, highway safety, social equity. This issue seems to touch almost every agency of state government.
It absolutely does. I mean, when I first started thinking about this, just as you said, I thought, you know, it's not that difficult. A few other states have done it. We have the medical dispensaries currently doing it. Why can't we just easily build on some of those successes? But then when you think about some of the themes and the priorities that are in Act 164, our enabling legislation, you start to realize that there are some contradictions that occur. You know, we've been tasked with moving very quickly on opening up retail stores, but we've also been asked to support social equity. And those at times can be contradictory. Certainly, you know, big multi-state and international operators have the ability to spend money very quickly and get businesses started up, and they can even run deficits for a few years. Things that just aren't available to kind of small cultivators and social equity applicants. You know, we're supposed to, you know, prioritize these small cultivators and give them accommodations. However, we have to, you know, deal with local municipalities and time, place, manner restrictions and other zoning issues. You know, again, like you said, we have to improve our public health outcomes, but also kind of generate some revenue for the state so that we can even invest in some of the issues that you've raised. So when you think about this plant, this cannabis plant, and trying to kind of create a tax and regulate system and put the imprimatur of the state on it, there's a lot of considerations and a lot that we need to kind of focus on as we sit at the intersection, really, of policy and politics and traditional Vermont values.
Julie, you mentioned one of the reasons you wanted to get involved in this issue had to do with justice. The Cannabis Control Board has been given the job of promoting social equity issues in all aspects of the creation of a cannabis marketplace. How do you see this developing?
So as a board, it's our role to develop the definition of social equity applicant in consultation with the Executive Director of Racial Equity in Vermont, the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, and our advisory committee. And we've already spent some time with Susanna Davis, who's the ED of Racial Equity for Vermont, and then also some national experts, Celine Teitel and Beau Kilmer. And, you know, in terms of how I see this developing, our legislation provides us with some tools. And one of those is the Cannabis Business Development Fund, which is a fund that will be comprised of a $50,000 one-time contribution from each integrated license. And that fund is for low-interest loans and grants, outreach, job training, and technical assistance for social equity applicants. And that's a start. But, you know, in terms of the board's responsibilities, in addition to the board having responsibilities, the market will have to take responsibilities as well. You know, to achieve social equity, the whole market will have to embrace it. Not everyone who was negatively impacted by the war on drugs or has a past cannabis conviction sees themselves in a cannabis career, but might see themselves in an ancillary business. And so how do we encourage you know, this marketplace to fold in and include those ancillary businesses instead of excluding, and to reach the people who would otherwise be excluded?
Kyle, you mentioned your interest in the agricultural side of this issue. In terms of growers, I know I've gotten a lot of questions from folks. Is the state giving any kind of preference to small growers or medium-sized growers? And how do you handle the balance between different size growers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you look at Act 164, authorizing legislation, the General Assembly expressed its intent and was quite clear that they want to move as much of the illegal market into the regulated market as they possibly can, and encouraging participation in the regulated market by small and local farmers. There's 904A, Section 904A of Act 164 gives us as a board a lot of power to really help small cultivators. And I think as we've thought about this as a board, you know, there's a couple things that we can do that come immediately to mind. Nominal fees, if possible, making the application process fairly smooth and easy, providing educational resources, FAQs, guidance on how to actually move an application from, you know, a starting point into being a part of this regulated community. I think one of the things that we've really focused on is hearing from small cultivators, because those waiving fees, making the application process fairly easy is something that obviously comes to mind, but we need to engage the public to understand more nuance on how we can actually help them, whether that's, you know, defining security and what an enclosed locked facility means. How can we help small cultivators in the packaging and labeling context, you know, testing? These are all things that can be expensive for a small cultivator that isn't fully capitalized and one of these big players moving in and about this. We've heard a lot about canopy sizes. Plant canopy is defined in Act 164, but how can we as a board fill out that definition of plant canopy to help folks understand what that 1,000 square foot canopy is for a small license holder?
Let's talk to Sue, who is calling from Williston. Hi, Sue. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My question or comment is, I am not in favor of cannabis sales, but if it does go through and all that, I think that the production or the sources of their cannabis should be exclusively from Vermont growers for, say, the first 4 years before they just start, you know, importing, because that will at least benefit Vermonters, you know. And then maybe it'll be easier to take whatever the negative consequences will be.
All right, Sue, thanks very much for your phone call. Kyle, how do you go about sort of following up on Sue's interest in having small growers? Do you have to reach a conclusion that the state needs X amount of marijuana on an annual basis, and then we're going to divide that up between small growers and larger growers? How do you determine what the demand is going to be and therefore how many growers you need?
Well, Chairman Pepper referenced in his introductory remarks, there was a RAND report that really looked at consumers in Vermont. That report's been updated, I believe 2018, and Chairman Pepper can correct me if I'm wrong, to look at Vermont, to look at what our market structure would be. That being said, New York coming online recently, or, you know, in the process of coming online, New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island not being too terribly far behind us in New York. What we're going to do as a board over the next month or so is update our market analysis again to reflect where we are in 2021. One of our first big deadlines as a board is October 1st of this year, and we need to have recommendations on our licensing types, our licensing tiers, fees associated with them, and how we're expecting this market to be structured. We're hopeful that over the course of the next couple months, with some help from some consultants, we'll be able to have a better understanding of various different licensing types and, you know, what's a good way to go about starting this process from how many licenses will initially be offered.
And to follow up on Sue's question, Kyle, do you see that X percentage goes to small growers? How do you prioritize small growers?
There's a lot of ways that we think we can prioritize small growers. I'm not sure we're there yet to answer Sue's question in specific, you know, terms. I think, you know, one of the things about Act 164 is one organization or corporation can hold each one type of license. So from a multi-state operator perspective, even if there is folks from out of state looking to come into Vermont, they would only be able to open one retail operation. Also in Act 62, which amended Act 164, the integrated license holders, the folks that get the first mover advantage, are required to source 25% of their product from small cultivators, and the board will consider on how to ensure that happens over the first 6 months that will be in operation.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Alan in Craftsbury. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on the air. What I'd like to know is, I think looking at the national scene, I think it's pretty inevitable that sooner or later the federal government is going to legalize cannabis nationwide. And I would assume that at that point it becomes like any other product, and the interstate commerce clause says that we can't do anything about it. So the idea of trying to set aside for small Vermont farmers becomes moot at that point. And just the lowest cost producers from California or Washington, wherever they may be, are likely to take the whole market. Is there anything to do to prevent that? And also, just like I don't like store-bought tomatoes, is the state going to really make sure that Vermonters always have the right to grow their own?
All right, you asked a couple of questions, Alan. James, what about the idea? We see, I think, some legislation that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer introduced in the last couple of weeks that I think would basically decriminalize marijuana, which is still a long way from legalization. But what about Alan's concerns that when we do get to federal legalization, it'll be a wide open market and Vermont growers really won't have much opportunity?
Yeah, it's something that I personally like to keep my eye on very closely. We do have at our board meeting tomorrow, which are open to the public, we're going to be getting an update on all of the federal legalization bills, because the Schumer bill is just one of many. But yeah, I mean, the concern is real. We heard very early on that mega cultivation operations in Oregon or New York State could supply all of the cannabis demand for the entire country. So we will expect at some point that federal legalization will happen, and our state borders will no longer act as a barrier to movement of this product. And so what does that mean for Vermont? Well, we're trying to learn the lessons that we have, well-trodden path of our cheese industry, our craft beer industry, and our maple syrup industry, which is people like to know their cultivators, they like to know their growers, they like to shop local, they like to buy local. If we're going to try and build a competitive advantage, we can't do it strictly on a volume basis. You know, the price of growing, 100,000 square foot canopies, the price of cannabis drops too low on that kind of generic type of cannabis. But what we can do is create a craft cultivation, diversified ecosystem here in Vermont that will be able to compete on quality. And I think that that's where Vermont really has an advantage. And we've seen it just with Vermont Organics. And we've seen it kind of in the creativity of our beer producers and our cheese producers. It's something that we very much would like to, keep our eye on. And we as regulators need to make sure that we're creating a welcoming environment for those craft cultivators and allow them to grow to kind of meet more and more of the demand of Vermont as they kind of move from that small cultivator canopy to larger cultivation.
Julie, you talked about your municipal background, and some folks might be wondering, what role do towns play in the development of a retail store in their community? Can they say, no, we don't want it?
Well, towns will have to decide to opt in this particular, the way our legislation is written, and that would have to be at a public meeting in their town. So some towns may do that at town meeting day. They may do it at other times. So right now, yes, there is an opportunity for towns to opt in for the retail portion only.
Now, how about for growers? Can a town say, we don't want to have either small or medium-sized growers in our community?
Well, so cannabis has been, through the legislature, has been identified as a commercial product. So they can't necessarily say that growers cannot grow within their town, but there will be some commercial regulation there.
All right. Let's go back to our callers and talk to Shannon, who is calling from Stratford. Hi, Shannon. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Colleen, when can small growers expect to see the guidelines, regulations, and applications rolled out?
Kyle, does that fall in your department?
I think that falls on all three of our departments. I'm going to let Pepper start us off.
Sure. So essentially, we've got a little, there is a timeline that exists in Act 164 and enabling legislation. Those timelines have all been kind of moved around a little bit. The pandemic caused the legislation to actually go into effect a few months later than it was supposed to, which had the knock-on effect of the board being sat late, us not being able to catch or have our fee structure approved during this legislative session. And that fee structure approval really has to be the kind of first domino to fall before we can even think about, developing rules and looking at license applications and granting licenses. So that being said, we have a big kind of seminal report due to the legislature later this year in October, which will lay out our fee structure for the entirety of the market, including tiers of cultivation and testing licenses, renewal fees, and retail. So we can't really separate that fee structure out from a lot of the rest of the work that we're doing, because there's a lot that goes into what our fee structure is going to be. So, we will need to, because of our fee structure kind of needs to match our operating expenses to a certain extent, we're also going to have to think about, production caps, for instance, or how to incentivize outdoor cultivation, how to define social equity. We also need to really think about, environmental standards, energy standards, wastewater standards, because we don't want that fee amount to be an absolute barrier when you have to comply with all these other regulatory structures. We don't want the fee of a small cultivator, for instance, to be the absolute barrier to them being able to enter the market. So I think the best thing for people that are very interested in seeking a license to do would be to keep a very close eye, one, on the work that we're doing, because essentially, when we're in preparing for this October 1st report, we're going to have to be doing a lot of the work that I just laid out simultaneously. And we're, broadcasting our meetings. We're going to be doing a lot of our work out in the open. And so for folks that are interested in seeking a license, I would say keep an eye on our board meetings and keep especially close attention to that October 1st report. And I think that'll be a really good status update as to where the board is and when you can expect to kind of see the rest of the program roll out.
James, you mentioned that the pandemic had a way of delaying some of the work of the Cannabis Control Board. As you look at the goal of having a retail store open in Vermont in October of 2022, does this timeline seem feasible?
So, again, that first domino is not going to fall, the kind of approval of the fee structure, which can only happen legislatively. until early January at the soonest. We're going to present our report with our fee structure to a few of the legislative committees in October, and they're going to hold a hearing, and I think hopefully either, you know, tell us to come back with something new or give tacit approval to what we've proposed. And then at that point, you know, I think people, members of the public, will have some confidence that that will be the kind of basic market contours that will be approved, hopefully very early on in January. But we're doing a lot to try and catch up. You know, we missed this legislative session. So what are we doing? First, we hired what I consider the best attorney in the state when it comes to navigating these kind of complex legislative and rulemaking processes. You know, her name is Bryn Hare. She's a longtime legislative counsel for the Vermont legislature. We've hired two consultants that have extensive background in the regulatory side of the cannabis industry, and they're going to advise our board and also lead our 14-member advisory panel. You know, break them up into subcommittees, give them discrete tasks, let them know kind of what's worked in other states, what hasn't, and let them create a system for us that is kind of uniquely Vermont, and funnel decision points up to the board so that we can do all of this work simultaneously. And we can start to kind of catch up and buy back some of the time that we missed because of that pandemic. So I can't say for sure what the new deadlines are, but I do think that by October, we'll have a pretty good sense of where the board stands with respect to kind of the milestones that were laid out in Act 164.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Chipper, who's calling from Brattleboro. Hey, Chipper, welcome to the program.
Thank you. So I'm working in outdoor cannabis production in Massachusetts for the legal market, and I have a couple concerns about the regulatory structure. I think one of the follies of their regulation is that they didn't distinguish between, they kind of took the regulatory structure from medical and indoor cultivation and pasted it onto the outdoor cultivation area, which makes it very difficult. It's unrealistic to be able to produce smokable flower for retail sale in outdoor conditions. And it's actually, I think it's excessive too. It's not that we're producing an unsafe product. It's just that it grows outside. It's more susceptible to organisms that are everywhere around us. And I was just wondering where you guys are at with all that, because I'd hate to see the regulation favor indoor cultivation, because to me that just seems crazy. It's something that grows very readily outside. Why have all the environmental costs of growing it inside? Thanks.
All right, Chipper, thanks for your phone call. Julie, any thoughts about that? Does the control board favor indoor growing or outdoor growing, or does it not really matter?
I think Kyle, with his agriculture background, I'll let him answer this particular question.
Yeah, thanks, Julie, and thanks, Chipper. I would submit at this point that there's going to be an opportunity for folks looking to grow indoor and outdoor in our regulated market. The board is also pretty understanding that, you know, growing practices change indoor to outdoor. Environmental stress and utility stress also change depending on if your operation style is going to be indoor versus outdoor. You know, one of the things that we're thinking through, Julie kind of mentioned earlier, right now this is zoned commercial. And so we're thinking as a board and working with our state government partners on how to manage cultivation and or processing in the context of an otherwise agricultural property. You know, there's going to be situations where a small cultivator wants to operate within that 1,000 square foot canopy designation that's zoned commercial, but is doing it as part of a diversified operation outside. So we're really dialing in with our partners at the Agency of Agriculture, at the Agency of Natural Resources, to understand those impacts. We'll likely in our maybe not on at that October 1st deadline where we've got to talk about fees and market structure and market types, but in our rulemaking process, I would imagine that there's going to be some differences between somebody pursuing an indoor cultivation style versus an outdoor cultivation style.
And just to add to that, I think going back to the municipal government question, you know, municipal governance right now will need to think about what their wastewater systems can handle, what their other environmental systems can handle, and along those same lines as Kyle is talking about, that will be impacted by both indoor and outdoor cultivation.
Let's talk to Mary, who's calling from Woodbury. Hey, Mary, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if you were aware of what happened in California with the legalization process, where applications, fees, environmental regulations basically prevented many of the small growers from being licensed and instead opened the door to the large corporations who could afford the overbearing regulatory fees and application fees.
Mary, that's a very good question. James, as you look around at the experience of other states, and we can look at Mary's concerns about California as well as other states that have a legalized retail cannabis market, do you see them doing some things that you say, nah, maybe that's not such a good idea in Vermont, or maybe this is something we should try to pattern our law after? But let's start with the California experience. Are you familiar with that, and do you feel like it has disadvantaged small growers?
It certainly has. I mean, I think very recently they had to, California legislature had to inject, I think, $100 million into a kind of sort of development fund for small cultivators to overcome some of these regulatory barriers to entry. So we, you know, of course, have been given a very specific directive to promote and prioritize our small cultivators. And we've been given, I think Kyle mentioned, Section 904A of Title VII to allow us to make accommodations for small cultivators. I mean, essentially what we can do is heavily regulate some of the bigger players and create carve-outs for some of the smaller players, keeping in mind that we don't want to have negative environmental impacts. I mean, I think tying to the last question that we heard from Chipper, I mean, I've been a cannabis pro cannabis advocate you know ever since I started looking into this issue. My faith in this got shaken a little bit at our last meeting when we heard about the energy intensive nature of indoor cultivation. Indoor cultivation of cannabis is not just the most energy intensive agricultural product to produce, it's also by unit the most energy intensive industry, and that's by a long shot. We have a comparison chart that was provided to us by Efficiency Vermont on our website that shows that the kind of next closest corollary is a paper mill, and you know, indoor cannabis cultivation, because of all the temperature controls and the lighting and the ventilation and the dehumidification, is more energy intensive than a paper mill. What I'm very grateful for is a lot of our state agencies have in Efficiency Vermont have seen the writing on the wall on tax and regulate for a number of years now, and they've prepared the market to be small cultivation friendly. Efficiency Vermont, for instance, you know, walked us through a lot of the rebates that they offer on efficient grow lights, HVAC systems. They'll even come to your farm and help you consult on what kind of greenhouse, the best practices around greenhouses and how to maximize your efficiency there. But you know, we as a board, just like we have some of these contradictions built into our law that I spoke about earlier, we also need to be very vigilant about how we balance you know, the regulatory aspect of this with kind of the environmental and energy impacts that it could have, and really try and let Vermont small cultivators help guide us in what we can do to help promote outdoor cultivation and break down these barriers to entry in the absence of banking. I mean, that's the kind of issue we haven't touched on yet, but you know, it's not like you can go to a federally insured bank and just ask for a loan for a cannabis industry currently. So we need to do what we can to listen to our small cultivators and see how we can create an encouraging regulatory environment for them to come into this market.
Yes, go ahead.
If I may jump in, I think this touches on social equity as well, because as a board, we have the ability to consider reduced fees for social equity applicants. And we know that the capital is that big barrier for most people in this market. So I think this question also touches on social equity.
Absolutely. I would agree with Julie on that. And just very, very quickly, the board is super cognizant that all these barriers to entries for small cultivators is something that we need to prioritize. And I would argue that even absent this mandate from the General Assembly, this is something that the board, the three of us, would be focusing on regardless. You know, I don't want any small cultivator to feel as if they need to go to a business advisor or legal counsel in order to get an application before the board. So we're going to be working as hard as we can to make the application process smooth for the for folks that are going to be submitting an application, and also ensuring on our end of the conversation that we can, you know, produce an answer to an application as expeditiously as we possibly can.
Julie, I wanted to touch on something that James mentioned right before the break, and that's the banking aspect of this. How do you go about encouraging loans and people to have grants and fund this entire cannabis operation when technically it's against the federal law, and so federally chartered banks can't be involved? Do I have that right?
I think so, but there are credit unions in other states that have created some interesting models of how they have dealt with this, either by creating subsidiaries or creating programs within their bank to handle this. And we do have those models to follow, and that will be, I think, fortunate for us as we look at this. There's also some pretty extensive guidelines through the Financial Center for it's called FinCEN, and then also BSA that I think we can follow, and that the banks in Vermont and regulators in Vermont will be looking at pretty closely.
Let's talk to Eric, who is calling from Eden Mills. Hey, Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing great.
So my question was, in towns where there's no zoning, how can it be? I've been laughed out of the town office before because my neighbor is in violation of covenants in his deed, but we have no zoning overall for the town, and I was laughed out of there. But now that town can have control over what business I can or can't bring into the town. That one's a little wonky to me. And the other was one of the speakers mentioned, like, our niche or craft artisanal industries like maple and cheddar and beer. But we've seen in the past several years there's been a recentering of the grading of maple because no one could keep up with Vermont and compete with us. So those are basically the things I wanted to present.
Okay, Eric, thanks for your phone call. Kyle, what about towns that don't have the zoning regulations that Eric is referring to?
Bob, if it's okay, I'm going to kick that question to Julie, our municipal government expert on the board.
Absolutely.
Sure. So as we create regulations as a board, we'll have to consider the different types of towns in Vermont, which run the gamut of having a ZA to themselves, having a fully built out zoning board and department, to those that, as the caller mentioned, have no zoning at all. And that will be on us to really think about the breadth and depth of our Vermont towns.
Let's talk to Laura, calling from Middletown Springs. Hey, Laura, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. My question, I am a nurse and I'm a mother of four young children. I'm curious to know what protections are going to be put in place in the regulation to make sure our children are not harmed by this. And I'd also like to know if you have pediatricians and school nurses advising you as you move forward so that we make sure that we do protect our children who can be very harmed by this.
Laura, thanks very much for your phone call. James, that was certainly a concern of a number of lawmakers when they voted for this bill, to have a comprehensive youth prevention and education component to it. What can you tell Laura?
It's incredibly important question and points that Laura raised. I think for a number of years now, as long as I've been paying attention, the Youth Risk Behavioral Survey, which is a voluntary survey that's anonymous and it's completed by middle school and high school students every year, has shown some very alarming trends with respect to cannabis. The ease of access is increasing, the perception of harm is decreasing, and that's been steady over the last at least half decade, whereas we've been seeing some of the reverse trends with respect to alcohol and tobacco use. So other regulated products are actually doing better than cannabis. And so what are we going to do as a board? Well, fortunately, one of the very early recommendations that I got out of Colorado was you need to have baseline data that you can track it with respect to youth prevention and use. And Vermont has funded a system called PACE Vermont, which was talked to us about by Dr. Vellante, who's a public health official, doctor at that really specializes in tobacco cessation, but has shifted her focus to cannabis use as well. And that's a very comprehensive report that gets filed every year, and it's got some incredibly detailed data on usage rates, and it goes a lot deeper than just kind of perception of harm and ease of access and some of these issues that are captured in the Youth Behavioral Risk Survey. So what that gives me some faith that we have a good baseline on kind of, you know, what's going on with our youth right now. So what are we going to do? As a board, we certainly are hearing from doctors. We have Dr. Levine, who serves on our advisory panel. And we have to work with the Department of Health on a number of issues related to youth prevention, advertising, and health warning labels. And we also, you know, very importantly, the legislature dedicated 30% of all the entire excise tax, capped at $10 million, to youth prevention efforts to really fill the gaps in prevention services that kind of are usually federally grant funded and may be around for a few years. They can be successful, but then they just disappear. You know, we talked to Prevention Works about some of the gaps in services that they have. We also, you know, another important piece, the entirety of the sales tax, the 6% sales tax on cannabis products, is going to go to filling the gaps on after school programs. So where are kids, you know, between 3 and 5 or 6, you know, there we heard from Holly Morehouse from the Vermont After School that I think that they can only service 50% currently of the demand for after school programs because, you know, there's transportation issues, accessibility issues, cost issues that come up, or just lack of services. So those are two really important pieces that are in Act 164. We as a board also have the authority and the requirement to approve all advertising. And we have very specific regulations in place that passed last year as to what we can and cannot approve. So importantly, you know, two of the kind of keys there are that we can't approve any advertising that's particularly appealing to people under 21, and we can't, or that is reasonably likely to reach an audience that's at least 15% 21. So this means no TV advertising, that's out. I think it would be very difficult to put something in a magazine, for instance, unless it was one that was only available, you know, at a retail location, you know, a cannabis retail location where they're checking IDs. And this 15% rule is actually, I think, the most restrictive in the country. I think Colorado and other legalized states have a 30% rule. So I think there's some things that we can do as a board. There's some things that the Department of Health can do. And there's some things that the legislature has already done in Act 164 to ensure that we are actually using our resources wisely and targeting them at prevention and after school programs.
Julie, some of our listeners might be wondering, do you want to add something, Julie?
I did. I just, you know, to Laura, I'm a parent of teenagers, so I completely understand her concerns. And, you know, if this is something I've thought about a lot as well. And just to clarify something that James said, those hours between 3 and 5 p.m. are the hours in which youth are most likely to engage in risky behavior. And so that's something as a parent that I think about when we walk into a meeting every time we go to a board meeting.
Julie, I was going to ask you, you know, we talk about level of taxation. It sounds like there's going to be a state excise tax. There's going to be a state sales tax. Municipalities will have the opportunity to have their own local tax applied to this product. As you look at sort of the big picture, Julie, do you think that this is going to put a dent in the illegal market as we move forward?
I certainly hope so, and I think that will occur over time. Do I think on day one the entire, legacy market will move into the regulated market? That may not be the case. But if we break down some of the barriers for cultivators, if we break down the barriers for retailers, and we make it accessible to them, I do think we can move some of the, or as much as possible of the illicit market into the regulated market.
Kyle, we had a question early on from one of our listeners that I don't think we have addressed yet. And that's folks who are thinking, I think his example was, I like to grow my own tomatoes. Will people still be allowed to grow their own cannabis?
Yeah, there is a home grow, personal grow. That's legal in state. I believe it's two mature plants, four immature plants. And that means from a household perspective. So if there's a situation where you have a roommate, you can't each grow two mature plants each. It's per household. And, you know, the board's aware of that. And we're, if we think there is adjustments that need to be made, we'll let the public know if that's the direction that we're going to go.
James, we're almost out of time, but do you think Vermont kind of missed the boat in some ways of not being an early state doing this kind of retail sale, or is it better to come a little later and learn from the experience of other states?
Well, from a revenue perspective, we certainly are not going to meet the kind of projections that were early on in the RAND report, that we would have been the only state this side of the Mississippi that would be a legal state to purchase. So from a revenue perspective, we missed the boat. However, as someone who's followed the progression and the evolution of this law, it has gotten better with every iteration. And, when I mentioned that we were looking at things from a consumer protection side, there was no talk about social equity back in 2015, 2016. We weren't really thinking that way. There was a heavy focus on law enforcement because we were operating under the Cole Memoranda at the time. And so, we were thinking about, highway safety. And so I think that we're in a better spot now.
This has been a great overview of the work of the Vermont Cannabis Control Board. James Pepper, Julie Hulbert, and Kyle Harris, thank you all very much for being on the program today.